Exactly 2 o'clock, so we will begin the afternoon session. And can I request all the participants to be on time for the lectures and afternoon discussions, please? That's an AS custom, and we would be very grateful to you if you honored the timings. Before I formally introduce Srilata, I have an announcement. So please make a note of this. You probably haven't got your programs today, but make a note that on the 19th of July, Tuesday, we will have a special lecture at 7 p.m. 19th of July, Tuesday, we will have a special lecture at 7 p.m. from our former illustrious Foreign Secretary, Mr. S.K. Singh. We just received a fax message. He has confirmed his participation. He will be coming on the previous day and will be speaking to you about his life and his work on the 19th at 7 p.m. Now, before I begin to formally introduce Srilata, let me tell you that we consider her a member of the Nias family, because in fact we were expecting that she would join us formally as head of the women's cell on the 1st of July, because the grants were being delayed due to the usual bureaucratic red tape. She hasn't formally joined us, but we consider her as part of NIAS. Srilata Bhatliwala is currently the Indian coordinator for DAWN. The word DAWN stands for Development Alternatives with Women for a New Era, an international South-based network of women researchers and activists. She is also a freelance consultant and trainer in the field of women's development. A master's in social work from the Tata Institute of Social Sciences, Bombay, Ms. Bhatliwala was earlier State Program Director of Mahila Samakhya Karnataka, a Government of India pilot program of education for women's empowerment. She has also been a research associate in the Women's Studies Unit of the Tata Institute of Social Sciences at Bombay, a senior research associate in the Foundation for Research in Community Health, and a research fellow of the Institute of Social Studies Trust at New Delhi. Ms. Bhatliwala helped found SPARC, which stands for Society for Promotion of Area Resource Centers, a Bombay-based NGO established to work with the urban poor. Among her current assignments, Ms. Bhatliwala is undertaking a study of women's empowerment programs in South Asia. She has to her credit over 35 published articles and papers, and several unpublished papers and monographs. Srilata, now the scene is all yours.
You know, I always hate being scheduled in the afternoon, especially in a post-lunch session, because you're always at a disadvantage, especially if the food is good. Everyone feels a little sleepy. But it is certainly an advantage to be given a subject like this to deal with after lunch, because whatever else happens, people are seldom dull or bored with it. The whole subject of women, the whole question of the women's issue in the country is inevitably controversial. It excites emotion, reaction, and response. So let's hope that the afternoon you'll be able to stay awake. But having said that, I'm going to tell you a little bit about how I'm going to use the time that's been given to me, the workshop this afternoon and tomorrow afternoon. What I thought was, precisely because the subject tends to excite more emotion than rational thinking, we would begin today by simply trying to understand the facts and figures as rationally and objectively as possible, so that by the end of today's session, we have some kind of a picture, a painting. I'm starting with almost a blank canvas, though I'm sure most of you are quite aware of some of the problems facing women in this country, and some of you have probably also worked on this issue being from the academic field. But I'm assuming that we're starting today with more or less a blank canvas, And on this canvas, we will paint in not emotions or opinions or feelings, but facts and figures and some of the ideas which have led to generating these facts and figures. So in today's session, I'm going to basically address myself to the situation of women in India today and try to paint a picture of the kind of discrimination which the facts tell us exists, not opinion. The discrimination which exists in the economic, social, and cultural spheres. Before we begin, I am usually tempted to begin with a historical analysis. I always believe it's best to understand the present, to go back into the past and try and find out how we got to where we are. Today, I'm resisting that impulse to a great extent because I feel that first, let's understand where we are. Because in the case of women, far too often we hold sweeping generalizations or very broad general beliefs which are untested by the actual data. So I thought if we first try and understand the situation, then tomorrow we can go more into a historical analysis of the roots of discrimination against women and also end on a positive note by looking at some of the efforts that are being made in the country, both by government and the non-governmental sector, to address these inequalities. But having said that, I feel it just doesn't make sense to look at these facts without some kind of backdrop. Now, my favorite historian to give us a backdrop against which to understand why women are where they are in our society today is Manu. Manu, the lawgiver, because perhaps more than in any other society except China, here in this country, we had someone who actually codified certain set of beliefs and attitudes about women's role in society. You may find some of these amusing, but make no mistake that in some form or the other, many of these ideas are still alive and well in today's society. I'm quoting now. This is an English translation. By a girl, by a young woman, or even by an aged one, nothing must be done independently, even in her own house. In childhood, a female must be subject to her father, in youth to her husband, when her lord is dead, to her sons. A woman must never be independent. She must not seek to separate herself from her father, husband, or sons. By leaving them, she would make both her own and her husband's families contemptible. Day and night, women must be kept in dependence by the males of their families, and if they attach themselves to sensual enjoyments, they must be kept under one's control. Though destitute of virtue or seeking pleasure elsewhere, or devoid of good qualities, yet a husband must be constantly worshipped as a god by a faithful wife, etc., etc. Now, we won't discuss this, but let us look at how some of these attitudes have come down to us in present-day society. We'll start by looking at what is the situation of women as far as the Indian Constitution is concerned. What are the legal rights guaranteed to us by the founding fathers of the nation? Can everyone see this? I think it's a little problematic, but let's try. There are three main articles in the Constitution which provide different kinds of guarantees of equality to women. The first is Article 14, which guarantees all citizens of the country equality before the law and equal protection under the law. Article 15, which guarantees that there will be no discrimination against any citizen on grounds of religion, race, caste, sex, or place of birth. Article 15 goes on to say in Section 3 that despite this provision that there will be no discrimination, yet the state, i.e. the Indian government, can and will undertake any programs which will discriminate in favor of women in order to correct the past imbalances against them. Article 16 goes on to guarantee equality of opportunity in all walks of life and no discrimination in employment, including in wages. So this is where we are supposed to be as the founding fathers of the country wished it. But let's look at what is actually happening. I'm going to start with a series of tables looking at the economic status of women, because as you all know, very often the real test of the position of any group in society is their economic well-being. And these data are all drawn from national sample surveys or from the Registrar General's office, unless it's otherwise specified. The first figure which is generally used is the work participation rate. This merely means the number of people above the age of either 15 or 5, usually it's above the age of 15, that is the adult working population who are actually in the labor force in some kind of wage earning activity. And here you can see that by this conventional definition of wage earning activities, you find that in rural areas, the male participation rate is slightly over 68%, whereas the female participation rate is just under 39%. In urban areas, the male participation rate is 57 compared to 17 for women. Now, I'm emphasizing on this conventional definition, that is, work as defined by the earning of wages, because in the 1970s and early 80s, because of the debates that began in the country regarding the status of women, and particularly a very important milestone in our history was the National Commission that was set up by the Government of India to inquire into the position of women in the country. This report, which was compiled by a number of extremely eminent experts drawn from different fields, came out with a report called Towards Equality. And one of the issues that this report raised was that the problem in defining or measuring women's economic situation and women's contribution to the economy is the concept of the invisibility of so much women's work. So before we go on to the other data, I'd like to introduce the certain conceptual frameworks that are used. Can I use this board? How do we define the notion of work? The general conventional definition is work is labor exchanged in the labor market for wages, either in cash or kind, right? Can everyone hear me? Yeah? Okay. Now, the definition, the expanded definition of work, which has been evolved by economists, by women's studies experts and feminist researchers, has tried to correct this rather narrow definition of work, recognizing the fact that if you define work this way, then A large amount of the work that women actually do, which is work in the physical sense, in the way physics defines it, that of burning energy through activity, gets left out. So we identified three basic forms of work done by women. One is, of course, production, which is the actual production of some kind of goods, raising crops, etc., etc., the conventional notion of production. Then, of course, the category of reproduction, which is to give economic recognition to the fact that if women did not reproduce by way of having children, there would be no labor force to continue production. So the work of reproduction itself is considered as work. The third form is called by different terms, by different experts, but I prefer this particular term, which is called subsistence reproduction. Now, this is a very important category of analysis, because this subsistence reproduction is all the series of activities which women do day in and day out, which are generally classified as housework and childcare. But the reason why it was given a more economic context was because it was realized that in the pre-industrial revolution days, there was very little division between the home and the workplace. People worked on their farms and their homes were located in the farm, so the division between home and work hadn't yet occurred. And so women did both productive activities in their fields, in raising vegetables, fruit, poultry, animals, etc. And at the same time, took care of their families by cooking, fetching fuel, washing, cleaning, looking after children, raising them, teaching them, etc., etc., in one and the same place. In the post-revolution, post-industrialization period, we have a split, where increasingly the workplace and the home became separated. And in that process, what happened was that more and more men joined the industrial workforce and more women remained at home and increasingly lost their role in production, which went more into the factories. I'm, of course, talking about a scenario which is, in a sense, still more relevant in the West than here, but it has certain applicability even in our context. So the women got driven more and more out of productive activities, so-called, into more and more the home-based activities. Now, the economic value of this subsistence reproduction is actually extremely high. Some economists tried an experiment of computing what would be the value of the work done by women in the home by way of cooking, childcare, cleaning, etc., etc., if you had to purchase those services in the market. Supposing women didn't do that work, what would be the amount of money it would cost you to go out and buy those services, to buy, you know, hire somebody to look after your children, hire somebody to cook, etc., etc.? And they realized that this is an enormous area of economic activity, because without this activity, this cannot take place. If you don't eat every day, you can't work. Things have to be cleaned. Children have to be reared. These are all activities which are contributing to the sum total of human welfare and progress. But they had never been given any recognition, particularly after the period of industrialization. So if you look at these three forms of production that women do, and you get an expanded definition of women's work, then we can re-look at the work participation rates and get quite a different picture. Is this clear? Please feel free if you have any question regarding the concept to interrupt me. Okay. Now, using this expanded definition, which particularly in our country includes the very, very important activities of fetching fuel for cooking, grazing animals, and water. Because as you know, the vast majority of our population lives in rural areas, and distances of water supply is a major issue, and that work is almost invariably or always done by women. So with the expanded definition, you can see the difference, the increase in the work participation rates by giving some kind of economic value to these other jobs that women do. Then even within the workforce, even within the conventional definition of work as something done in exchange for wages, let's look at where women are. Women in the labor force were actually participating in the family labor category. Because as you may be aware, in our country, the practice is often that the male head of household is hired to perform a particular activity and is paid a wage on the assumption that other members of his family, his children, his wife, etc., will contribute to the actual work produced. So unpaid family labor is 38% of women compared to 13% for men. Casual labor, 34% compared to 26% for men. And self-employment, because this again involves access to credit, going to the market, etc., where other kinds of restrictions operate, you can see that far fewer women are in this category than men. Now, outside the labor force, let's look at those people who by age qualify to be in the labor force but are not. What are the reasons why they're not in the labor force? And let's look at the male-female differentials here. 62% of men report their non-participation in the labor force is because they are engaged in some kind of educational activities, whereas only 21% of women report this. The conventional domestic role, that is the poor beleaguered housewife or housework, 38% of women are doing that full-time and therefore not in the labor force compared to 1% of men. If you take the expanded domestic, that is fetching of fuel, grazing of animals, childcare, etc., 17% of women are doing that, again compared to 1% of men. And 24% of women are not in the labor force because of old age, illness, or other reasons, compared to 36% of men. Now, there is a widely held belief that part of the reason why that discrimination against women is strongest among the poorest. Let's look at some figures which show us that this is not in fact true. In order to understand this table, we need to look a little bit at this concept of the inside-outside dichotomy. As we see right from Manusmriti onwards, the whole gender role for women, the socially constructed gender role for women, emphasizes the values of restriction, seclusion, and being in the inside world. The inside world, the world of the home and the family, is considered the right place for women. And the outside world, in the economy, in productive activities, in government, in political participation, etc., is considered an inappropriate world for women, not where they belong, and that is much more the men's world. But if we look at the percentage of women's time in agricultural activity, and if we compare that with their economic status, what we actually find is a picture where the very poorest are in fact engaged much more, spend much more of their time in other kinds of work, in, for instance, wage labor outside or in their own agricultural activities, then women from landed and upper income group families. These acronyms here stand for landless wage labor, marginal farmers and small or petty entrepreneurs, marginal farmers, small and medium farmers and entrepreneurs, small and medium farmers, large farmers, landlords and large entrepreneurs. Now what you see here really is, if you look at this circle, the domestic work, I'm sorry that my artwork isn't very good. I didn't have very good implements either. But if you look at the proportion of time of women spent on domestic work, you'll see that it's far higher in the really upper income groups and lower in the poorer groups. Because in the case of poorer families, in fact, active discrimination against women in terms of their mobility and their seclusion is much less, because the family simply cannot afford to keep their women at home. Women have to go out and do wage labor as much as the men do. This is another interesting table, which is from the Towards Equality report, which also introduces us to another major factor that we have to understand in looking at women's status within India. And that is the very strong north-south regional divide in the situation of women. This committee used the practice of parda within the family as an index of the degree of restriction in different parts of the country. Now what is interesting is that this is not the parda, of course, doesn't mean just a parda in the sense of a burqa, but it also means, you know, veiling and covering the face, dupatta, chunni, whatever. This is women veiling in the family. That means that even within the household, for instance, the daughter-in-law or the sister-in-law is not allowed to show her face to, you know, the older brothers-in-law or father-in-law, whatever, which is, in one sense, it's at an extreme end of the spectrum in terms of seclusion and restriction of interaction of women. Now, you can see that there is really a very low incidence of this in the four southern states. It's not too bad in the eastern states, but in the northern states, the western, central, and northern states, except for Maharashtra, you find this is practiced to quite a great extent. And there's some very interesting work that has been done by what I think they're called cartographers, people who prepare maps, showing that if you take India and plot the status of women by almost any indicator, work participation rates, degree of seclusion, distance of marriage, degree of interaction with the natal family after marriage and so on and so forth, what you will get is, please excuse my very poor map, you get a line something like this. And below this line, you find there is a higher status, and below, above this line, a lower status in almost all the indicators. But there are exceptions. This chart, which shows us the difference in wages, which our constitution guarantees should not exist between men and women, is a chart showing the difference in agricultural wages between female and male agricultural workers. Now, what you find is that in these six states, women earn between 80 but below 100% as much as men. There is no state in India, incidentally, where equal wages are paid to both male and female workers in agriculture, regardless of whether they're doing the same work. And the same is true even in the construction industry. In these states, women get between 70 to 80% as much as men. And here you see that the sharpest contrast, where women are paid nearly half, just about half of what male wage laborers are paid is Tamil Nadu, which is ostensibly supposed to be one of the higher status states, but in fact, in terms of wage discrimination in agriculture, it's extremely high. But what this shows us is that even though there is a constitutional guarantee of equal pay and equal employment opportunity, and that is supposed to be implemented through giving the same pay for same work, there is in fact discrimination in many fields. Now later on, if we have time in the discussion period, I'll share with you some interesting cases. My favorite is where somebody in Kerala applied for a job with the Kerala Public Service Commission, two women in fact, and they had equal qualifications as the male candidates and they were not selected. They went to the Kerala High Court on grounds of discrimination on the grounds of sex, claiming that they had not been given the jobs primarily because they were women. Now, the Public Service Commission, in its reply to the court, stated that the reason these women were not hired was because they could not ride a cycle. But when the High Court made an inquiry into all the men who had been selected, they found that 30% of the men who had been selected could not ride a cycle either. So these are the kinds of discrimination stories that you come across. This is again a chart showing you the differential wage rates in different states, and you see again the pattern, and you see that in the states where the highest wage rates are paid, Haryana, Punjab, the Green Revolution areas, there is also a very sharp differential between the male and female wage rates. Now that's as far as wages go, but let's look at who actually does a lot of work and how do wages reflect the actual work done by men and women in different parts of the country. Now, as a social worker, one of the first things that I encountered in almost any community survey that we did, going back to what I said earlier about the various forms of production that women are engaged in, part of the problem of the invisibility of women's work, that it's invisible even to women. Even women don't recognize the work they do as work because society doesn't recognize it. So when we would do a survey and we would ask, आप क्या काम करते हैं? Women would invariably answer, मैं तो कुछ नहीं करती, मैं तो घर में हूँ. And yet, when we did time budget studies, asked her to describe her day from morning till night, we invariably found that the women worked 14, 15, 16 hours a day. But their own definition of themselves is, I'm not a worker, I don't work. Now, partly because of this, and partly in an attempt to understand the way in which work patterns are organized in villages, several studies have been done in different parts of the country. These are micro studies. And these are generally called time budget studies or time allocation studies. One set of data I'm giving you is from a village in Rajasthan, one is from a village in West Bengal, and one is from a village not too far from here, right in Karnataka. What you find by looking at this chart is once again that if you look at women's work in the context of agriculture and some allied activities, you find that they do either much less than men in those given activities, depending on the socio-cultural norms of that area. Because you see, for instance, in Karnataka, it's almost equal, in fact, slightly more by women. Whereas in West Bengal, women are participating much less in agricultural activities than men. And in Rajasthan, again, almost equal. But when you come down the work scale to what the census calls Code 93 activities, it's called Code 93 because that was the code in the census and the NSS, for these activities, that is fetching water, fuel and water, you find the contrast quite sharp, where there is hardly any work contribution by men to these activities, and there's a much larger contribution by women. Now, this is in hours per day, by the way. In terms of domestic, that is cooking, cleaning, and childcare, you find that the differential is even sharper, going up to 5.2 in Karnataka. Now, probably if there had been a study, I did try to get that data for you from the Garhwal Hills. In this category, code 3, you find that women spend about 4 hours a day or more on this fetching water and fuel because of the deforestation that has taken place in that area. Now, if you contrast this with the totals, you'll see that where in an individual category of work, especially like in agriculture, women's labor contributions may be lower, their overall work contribution to the family is very high. Particularly in the Karnataka and Rajasthan study, it was significantly more than that of the men. Now, in return for this work, what kind of health do women have? Are they able to sustain this level of activity? Well, in the study that I did here in Karnataka, in this last category of village which is on this chart, I found that in fact there was a calorie deficit, that the amount of food consumed by the women per day was not quite equal, at least on averages, to the number of calories they were expending. Now, this again is something which is socially coded and internalized by women, that men work more and therefore they should have more food. And I think this is a practice even in all our families, middle class, upper class, working class, where girls are taught, no, give that to your brother, let, you know, the men of the household eat first, etc. So there's this deeply internalized deprivation, it's as much a self-deprivation as anything else, of food, because of the belief, the dominant belief, that women do less work than men, even though the facts speak otherwise. I'm not suggesting that men don't do any work, by the way. Okay. Let's look at some of the reasons why women's role in the workplace and in the economy has been so circumscribed. One clue, or one set of clues to this, we can get by looking at women's position vis-a-vis education. Now, as you know, probably the government of India has made a greater effort in the field of education after independence than in almost any other social sector. At present, we spend about 2.3% of our gross national product on education, and today the government prides itself on the fact that virtually every village in the country has at least a primary school. There may be a significant percent without school teachers, but the infrastructure has been created. Yet, so long after independence, we still find that there's a very sharp differential in educational achievements of women and in even basic literacy rates. I'm sure you're familiar with a lot of this data. That literacy rate of women is almost half that of men, even in the 91 census. The mean years of schooling, that is the average number of years of schooling that a person above 15 reports having gone through, is only 1.2 years for women, whereas it's 3.5 for men. The primary enrollment rate, that is the enrollment rate into primary school, is still lagging behind. Government was hoping that by the 6th five-year plan, we would achieve 100% enrollment for female children, but that hasn't happened. And the enrollment rate actually here is now, it's about 103%. It's even more than 100% for boys, because they get re-enrolled in other schools as well, and there's some doubling of the data. Now, enrollment rates themselves are a little deceptive, because all of you are from the education field, so you know. You know, you go and enter the child's name on the register, on the master, but it doesn't actually reflect at all on attendance rates. And what has been found by micro-level studies and even by studies done by the NCERT is that if you look at actual attendance rates in schools, it's almost one third for girls. That girls are extremely irregular in attendance because of family responsibilities or being kept back from school for various other reasons, and it's somewhat higher for boys. But apart from the actual attendance rate, even if you look at the actual enrollment rate, that is when they go and actually check whether the child who is reported to have been enrolled is actually enrolled, you find that in the case of girls, it's only 51% are actually enrolled. Now, the secondary enrollment rate is another very important and sensitive indicator for us of what happens to girls who are even enrolled in primary school. That this is actually a way of getting the dropout rate. So we see that less than 15% of girls who entered primary school actually enter secondary school, because this is the period at which there is a massive pulling out of girls, and parents invariably say, as they used to say to me in when I was working in Maila Samakya and we used to discuss this issue, you know what they used to say, I'll say it in Kannada and then try to translate it for you, ayo badri hech buddhi ban bidate. This means jada hoshiyar ho jayenge. Do you all understand Hindi?
Yes.
Huh? You know, they'll become too smart, it's enough. They went for 3-4 years, it's enough. Now let her stay at home and let her help the mother. So the dropout rate is very, very high for girls compared to about 43% of boys who actually make it into the secondary school level. The college enrollment rate for women is, of course, quite poor in rural areas. I think partly distance and so on is a major factor, but also it is not as high as it should be even in urban areas. In higher education, but of course here we're talking now about a much smaller class of people who have the opportunity and the means to attain higher education, the ratio of female to male, I'm sorry, this should be the other way around. Female to male in higher education is about 33 female students for every 100 students. But the interesting thing is that in some sectors like medicine, in fact recently, I think 2 or 3 years ago when I was still with the education department, there was a crisis faced in some of the medical colleges because the number of women graduates, women who qualified through the entrance exam was for the first time almost the same as the number of boys, or even greater in some cases. So some of the colleges had received about 60% applications from girls who had achieved that requirement level for medical admission. And so there were these, you know, sort of emergency meetings to decide what to do with this crisis. How can they give 60% of the seats to girls? Now, let's look at health. This is the really telling area which gives us the greatest insight into what is happening in this country to women. The famous economist Amartya Sen coined an expression. He said, "I want to know where are the missing women." He was referring to the decline in the sex ratio which has been taking place in the country since 1911. What the sex ratio itself is a concept that requires some explanation. If any of you are teachers of science, particularly of biology and so on, you would be familiar with the fact that nature, in its wisdom, actually determined that in every species, the female would be the stronger biologically in terms of her survival capacity. And nature determined this for the very simple reason that the survival of a species really rests on the health and the survival of the female of the species in those where the female is the primary reproducer. So it's no difference in womankind that if nature was left to itself, first of all, a larger number of conceptions that take place are of female fetuses by about 100. I think for every 1,000 conceptions of males, there are about 1,100 females conceived at the fetal level. So that there are always a larger stock of women in the species, in the pool of the species. This is obvious because a few men and a large number of women can ensure the survival of a species almost indefinitely. But if you reverse this ratio, then the species is in difficulty because you're reducing the pool of women means you're reducing the number of those who can reproduce the species and the species is threatened. Now, human beings are the only form of mammal which have managed to reverse nature's law, and through their system of deprivation and discrimination against the female of the species have actually brought about an imbalance in nature's law. This imbalance is reflected by demographers and statisticians in what is known as the sex ratio, that is the number of women for every 1,000 men. Now, in almost all developed countries and even in neighboring countries of ours in Asia, you'll find that for every 1,000 men in the population, there would be at least 1,025 women. That is the normal ratio that exists. India is one of the few countries where the ratio is severely disadvantaged to women. And this ratio has been falling almost steadily for the last 50 to 70 years. This census, there was a hope that the ratio would have gone up because it was 935 in the last census in 81 and it's gone down to 927. Worse, look at the ratio I've tried to mark in blue. I don't know whether it's very visible to you. But in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 states of our country, the ratio has gone below 900. Which is a really critical situation, because to get that kind of imbalance in the sex ratio at this macro level, it means a huge in the entire country which has a sex ratio normal, approaching what nature would consider healthy and normal, and that's Kerala with 1036. Now, what are the reasons why the sex ratio has gone down to this miserable level? The most obvious one is the deprivation of food that takes place from birth to the female. This came home to me very sharply when I was working with a group of construction labor in Bombay. Glaringly in some groups, but among the very poor, and again if you look along the north-south divide, you do find that there's a very glaring difference between the two. Now, this is a study that was done. The neglect of the girl child because of the lower value placed on the girl as such comes out regardless of income. This again is linked to a certain set of notions of the purpose of the female. Now, as we all know, the girl is treated or is seen as an economic liability from the time she is born, whereas a boy is an economic asset because he is going to earn for the family, add to the family's wealth, etc. A girl is what they call in the north as paraya dhan. She comes and she goes and she becomes part of another family and she only adds to their well-being, not to ours. Plus, there is the problem of dowry. So that to feed and take care of this girl and then spend in a, you know, invest in her only to have her go away, plus take wealth from the household, that is the kind of psychology that's operating. And since both men and women imbibe the psychology from early childhood, that deprivation is being practiced by mothers. You know, they become the instruments of the deprivation of their daughters. Similarly, if you look at death rates, death ratios by female and male in different age groups, again you find that the balance goes against the natural balance. The female of the species is biologically stronger and is built to withstand greater degrees of morbidity and survive compared to the male of the species. Yet we find in many countries like India, particularly from the ages of 0 to 35, the percentage of female deaths is higher than that of male deaths. This is because A, food deprivation, B, deprivation of health care or urgent medical care as compared to boys, and during the reproductive age groups when deaths from various complications arising from pregnancy and childbirth are very high. Which brings me to the whole question of women's reproductive health. India has the dubious distinction of having one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the world. I think it's lower only than countries like Burkina Faso or Belize or something like that. Perhaps marginally higher than Bangladesh. But I've mentioned these neighboring countries' figures just to give us an idea of how bad the situation is in our own country. 550 is for every 100,000 live births. That is, for every 100,000 deliveries that take place, 550 women die. Only 33% of births are attended by trained personnel. The percentage is even lower in rural areas, sometimes less than 5%. 30% of all babies born are what are classified as small for dates or low birth weight because of inadequate nutrition to the mother during pregnancy. And if you look at the causes of maternal mortality, the majority of causes in the Indian context are preventable if adequate antenatal care was given to the mother. If we look at some of the general health data, I've put these down because I thought it would be interesting for us to look at another aspect of the North-South divide. Ashish Bose, a couple of years ago, when doing some analysis of demographic and economic data, coined the term the Bimaru states. I hope any of you who are from these states won't take it personally, but what he found was that if you take almost any kind of statistical data in India, and if you separate the four states of Bihar, Madhya Pradesh, Rajasthan, and Uttar Pradesh from the rest of the country, the statistics for the rest of the country look much, much better and much healthier, and the Bimaru states look really terrible. And so the Bimaru states data always pulls down the national averages, pulls down whatever achievements have been made, whether it's in the field of women or child health or wages or incomes or whatever. This is particularly telling if we contrast certain male-female differentials. Life expectancy, which is another important indicator of health, where again biologically women always are supposed to outlive men. In India, until this last census, life expectancy for women was always less than that of men. For the first time, it has increased over that of men. But if you look at the Bimaru states, you'll see the opposite, that life expectancy of women is still about 2 years less than that of men, as compared to the rest of India, where it's about 4 years more. If you look at the infant mortality rate, another very telling figure, you'll find that in the rest of India, for the first time, infant mortality for females has gone below that of males. Similarly, in the rest of India, 76 and 82, but in the Bimaru states, the mortality rate for infants, female infants, is still higher than that of male infants. So almost any of the figures that you take, you'll find that there is this sharp contrast. I want you to also take a look at this figure, the fertility rate. This is another telling area where we have not made sufficient progress. Because of the confinement of women to the role of reproduction, because of the obsession with the need to produce sons, or what is known as the son preference syndrome, the fertility rate is still extremely high. So women basically spend a lot of their reproductive years simply having child after child. They have very little access to information about contraception. If they have access to it, there is no permission to use it, even if they are highly motivated. So there's this kind of clash between the state, which wants to implement family planning in a very aggressive way and bring down birth rates, and old family customs, beliefs and traditions, which are working against that, and women are somewhere sandwiched between the two. Even in the area of the mean age of marriage, we have just about now crossed what is supposed to be the legal age of marriage for girls of 18. But again, if you look at the Bimaru states, it's 17. And in fact, in rural areas in the Bimaru states, it's still below about 15 to 16. I have some details here about the spread of STDs, HIV, AIDS, etc., and the vulnerability of women to these. But because of the time shortage, I'm going to skip that. Maybe we can talk about it in the discussion. I'm going to end with these figures, which are again, I think, an important aspect of addressing the status of women, though not necessarily the most important aspect of it. I think some of the other things we have brought out in the area of health, of education, of economic status are more important in a mass way. But these figures are also very telling of what is happening to women in our society. These are different types of crimes against women, which have become now recorded and registered. And as you know now, the police departments of most states have created special cells for crimes against women and for domestic violence and so on. What you find here is not actually, in my opinion, now here I'm venturing an opinion and not a fact, is not actually an increase so much as an increase in reporting. Because crimes like rape, molestation, sexual harassment, abduction, dowry-related harassment and dowry burnings, or ill-treatment by husband and in-laws, domestic violence. In our tradition, it has never been something which is taken outside the family. As you know, it is something that is treated as secret. It's treated as part of women's fate that they have to suffer these indignities at the hands of their marital family or husband or whoever it may be. And so, and particularly crimes like rape, which deal with a woman's sexuality and the whole notion of chastity being, there is still a reluctance because the bias within the law operates at three levels. One is the way the law is framed itself. For example, if you take laws relating to the Devadasis or prostitution, Pita, what you find is the way the law is framed puts the maximum punishment on the woman and her family. In the case of the Devadasi law, the most stringent imprisonment and fines are levied on the Devadasi herself and on her immediate family. So when they actually dedicate the girl with this Muttukattodu ceremony, if that is reported by, say, a neighbor, the police arrest her and her family and not the brothel keepers of Bombay and Pune who are waiting in the village to take her as soon as the ceremony is performed and sell her to the brothels of Pune and Bombay. So you find there are these kinds of problems where within the law itself, another example I would like to give you is the rape law, which has now been amended, where earlier the law was framed that the burden of proof, that is of proving that a rape had taken place, was on the complainant, the woman. Whereas now in the mid-80s, an amendment was made and the burden of proof is now on the accused. The second problem is in awareness of the law, in gaining access to the law itself, because with the kind of literacy levels that we saw, with the general kind of seclusion of women, their lack of exposure to many different kinds of information and new programs and services that are available to them, even if a law exists on paper, it is difficult for women to utilize it. And if they actually go to utilize it, then they encounter another set of barriers. Very often there's family pressure, ki nahi nahi chhod do, you know, badnaam ho jayenge, the whole world will come to know, just keep quiet. There's still this kind of pressure. Or within the judicial system itself, you'll find there are biases which come out, especially in cases like rape and conjugal rights and so on, where the courts also tend to take the view that if you're really a good woman, then you wouldn't have been raped. So the assumption is always that you asked for it, you know. So there are serious problems, but the fact is that at least at the level of the law itself, of the statutes, there is an increasing awareness of the need to provide some protections to women. So I'll stop with this. I've tried to give you, I hope you don't feel sort of bludgeoned with facts and data. But I'll stop now, and maybe now we can have a more informal discussion and responses to this. So we're again after lunch. Not too sleepy, I hope. Yesterday, when we concluded, we had looked at the broad sort of statistical profile, at least in some key areas, which gave us some idea of the nature of discrimination against women in Indian society. We also had some discussion after the presentation, where some of the key issues that came up were, for instance, women's role in their own oppression, things like amniocentesis, etc. And I think one of you made a very significant statement. So I'd like to start today's presentation and discussion with that statement. This was that if women really want to, if they want to make a change, why don't they as individuals resist? Something of that nature was said yesterday. Do you remember? I think it was in the case of Hema Malini as an example, that why don't women just stand up to this and say no? You know, I will not abort my female child, or I will not accept this kind of treatment. Now, what I've put up here today is really an attempt which many, many of us who are involved both in women's studies as well as in organizing women and working with women at the grassroots level have tried to analyze and understand about why precisely it is not so easy for women to say no. What are the factors which are perpetuating various forms of discrimination? Because we felt that unless we get to the root of that, understand the sort of root causes of this discrimination and subordination, we don't really get a very useful clue as to how to change it. So this is the kind of model that I've evolved out of these discussions over the last 2 years, when I have been visiting projects and programs, not just in India, but all over South and Southeast Asia, and trying to understand how people look at the whole question of women's situation in society and what are the root causes of it. This inquiry itself is something that I would like to explain. If we look historically over the last 40 years of any kind of grassroots work, we find that the terminology and the concepts infusing that work have changed quite a lot over the last 4 or 5 decades. At the time of independence and soon after, inspired by Gandhiji's attempt to mobilize large numbers of women during the freedom struggle, to encourage them to come out of their homes and participate in a very radical political movement for the independence of the country from British rule. It was his desire, in fact, his words were that what we are doing to our women is unconscionable in any humane society. This is his own description of the situation of women. At that time, he instructed Sarvodaya workers in their work in villages to make a special attempt to mobilize women. And what he told them is, bring them out of the four walls of the home and get them to be involved in community processes and in political processes at the grassroots level. Because he felt that until women break out of the chaukat, the four walls, the courtyards in which they were imprisoned, there would be no long-term sustainable change in their status in society. So at that time, the focus was quite radical because it was on political participation. And you can't imagine anything which is more of a contrast from the seclusion and veiling and being within the home to participating in political struggles. But after independence, there was a slide back. After the freedom struggle, after the country won independence, you find that even a large number of the women organizers of the Congress Party or even women Sarvodaya workers, many of them went back into their homes and back into their traditional roles as wives and mothers and so on. And increasingly, programs aimed at women were cast much more in the framework of welfare or upliftment. Now, welfare, as I'm sure many of you are aware, in its very concept is more by nature of charity or dole. And all it says is that in the present structure, there are some people who are particularly disadvantaged or marginalized by the structure, and we need to uplift them. But it doesn't really question whether the overall structure and the position of women within that structure is a just or equitable one. So we saw a long period, really until the 70s, of more or less dole or charity-oriented programs with a few sparks here and there of programs aiming at developing women's skills, their managerial ability, encouraging them towards economic independence, and so on. But from the 70s onwards, after the Towards Equality report, which I mentioned yesterday, which came as a kind of a shock, it was a kind of a national shock, because the facts and figures that it brought out showed that after nearly 30 years, very, very little progress had been made, even in areas where considerable progress had been made in general, little impact had really been felt on the whole question of women and their status. So after the 70s, once again, there were more radical approaches which tried to stress much more on involving women, and the term that then came about was community participation or people's participation, and then women's participation. So a lot of grassroots programs tried to go out and systematically involve women in the various development programs and schemes that they were implementing at the grassroots level, for instance, in the area of health. But again, one of the problems or drawbacks in this approach as well was that the nature of the program in which women had to participate was planned and designed and its objectives determined by someone outside, not by the women themselves. Secondly, these participation programs were not really informed by a sensitivity towards the triple burden which I described to you yesterday. The fact that because of women's multiple roles, both within and outside the home, it was really very difficult for them to find the time and the space to participate in programs which were predetermined or designed by others, and so perhaps didn't take into account their work schedules and other pressures and burdens on them. However, there was a certain increase in the participation of women in some of these programs over the 70s. From the 80s onwards, with the understanding and the analysis that had been gaining strength over the previous decades, and most importantly perhaps with the rise of the women's movement in the late 70s, what came to be known as the empowerment approach or women's empowerment became increasingly popular or widespread in usage. I'll just put that word down here. Have most of you heard this word? I believe even companies like Godrej use this word to sell their refrigerators. Empower yourself and liberate yourself with a frost-free refrigerator or whatever. But we're using the word a little differently. Now, why was this term empowerment coined in the first place? It really came about as a result of certain international processes that were going on at that time. It was greatly influenced by the work of Paulo Freire. Have you all heard of Paulo Freire? A priest working in Latin America, a very radical Catholic priest who developed a concept called consentization. I'm not sure I can spell it correctly, but I'll put it down here. Freire's basic thesis was that there is no point in working towards any kind of broad-based social change without first raising the awareness of the poor themselves, the oppressed group themselves, and creating an environment where the poor themselves would sit down and analyze the sources of their disempowerment or their powerlessness in that given structure, and where the poor themselves identify the strategies they want to use to bring about a change in their status in the larger society. That is what I'm putting it very crudely and very briefly, but because it's a very elaborate concept to explain. So that was consentization. Now, Freire didn't particularly apply this concept, or in his own analysis didn't necessarily stress on gender and gender discrimination as an area for consentization, but applied it more broadly at the whole level of poverty as a whole. But a number of Latin American feminists who began using the Freirean approach in their own work in slums and rural areas in organizing women in Latin America, they began to call their work, which was addressed primarily to women and concerned itself with women's issues, they called it popular education. And from the notion of popular education came the idea of women's empowerment. But the term empowerment is also used to describe programs or processes or strategies which attempt to mobilize the poor in general or any oppressed group in particular to try and work towards changing their own circumstances. Now you can see here in this continuum the change, the conceptual change and the strategic change, starting from welfare, where I am better off than you, I feel sorry for you, so I come and do something for you. But in that relationship, the basic power equation, my greater power and your lesser power, remains intact. Secondly, your dependence on me to provide that welfare continues. You never become, as a result of my welfare, as a result of my dole, you don't become liberated from the need for that dole. Because in that process, I retain control of the sources, of the resources, which you require to break out of this relationship of dependence. To the concept of empowerment, which really attempts to empower the oppressed group themselves to autonomously and independently take control of their circumstances and bring about a change. Okay, with this very brief introduction, let me now come to the model of why we're looking at the concept of empowerment in the context of women. Now, if you look at this word, you see that the key, the central operative concept within empowerment is, of course, power. So those of us who were trying to understand the whole question of the roots of women's subordination felt that in order to understand this, we have to first understand how the whole power structure, the whole societal structure in which we live, both as men and as women, how it looks and how it operates, and what is it that gives power and sustains power in that structure. Now, what we felt was, I don't know if some of you are familiar with traditional Marxist analysis, where they had three categories of land, labor, and capital. I think that was the three, and that was the analytical categories they used. But what we've identified is that the source of power really comes from the control, access to, and control over four basic categories of resources. Material resources, which includes land, forests, water, etc. Human resources, extremely important in the case of women, because as we saw yesterday, women's labor and their bodies in the form of their sexuality and their reproductive power is a resource which is controlled by someone else. Then financial resources, access to money, money markets, credit, etc. And most importantly in today's world, something which Marx didn't really recognize or look at, is intellectual resources, that is knowledge and information. And as you can all see, in today's world, knowledge and access to knowledge and information is perhaps one of the greatest sources of power. Even if I don't have any of these, if I have control over this or access to this, it gives me a great deal of leverage in society, because we're calling it an information society where the knowledge base is exploding, and those who have access to that knowledge get greater and greater control even over these three things. So with access to and control over some or all of these resources, a certain group of people, you may call it a class or whatever, gain greater power in the social structure, and other people get marginalized in the social structure. So a certain kind of pattern of power, or what we call a power structure, emerges. Now, when this structure is emerging, if we look at it historically, at the early stages, when power is shifting perhaps from the hands of one group to another, the role of force, of raw physical power, coercion, or the threat of force is quite strong in putting this power structure into place. If you look back into prehistory, there is a lot of evidence that human society was, for nearly 30 or 40,000 years, there are arguments about how long, basically matrilineal. Not matriarchal. I'm not using the word matriarchal because it's not clear whether it was the rule of the mother, but they were certainly matrilineal. Now, societies were matrilineal at that time, at an early stage of civilization, when male role in reproduction was not very clearly understood. For all that human beings knew, women had this magical, mysterious, perhaps divine power to give birth and ensure the survival of the species. So the most important figure was the woman, particularly as a mother. And research has shown that whether you look at in the heart of Amazonian Brazil, or in early Africa, or in early tribes of the East Indies, or in India itself for that matter, almost universally, all over the world, the dominant form of divinity, of Godhead, was the mother goddess. And the figures show her with the large breasts and the very large belly to symbolize the power women had to give birth, and therefore were divine. Now, as time went on, particularly after human beings learned how to domesticate animals, they began to understand the male role in reproduction. At the same time, populations began increasing, survival rates increased, so pressure of population on land became greater, and wars and competition over land increased. When competition over land increased, there were conflicts between clans and tribes, and in these conflicts, obviously, it was the males who were sent out to fight. Now, the reason they were sent out to fight was perhaps not so much because women couldn't fight or didn't have the courage or the physical power to fight, but because it was very important for women to remain alive in order to nurture the next generation. Another important reason was that while males had a major role in hunting, women were doing gathering. And many historians have analyzed that the supply of food to the clan was far greater from gathering, because it was a daily perennial subsistence activity, than hunting, which with the level of technology that existed at that time was risky and irregular. Perhaps you would kill something, perhaps you wouldn't. So as a source of food, again, women's role in gathering was very important. So it was important for clans and tribes to protect the women, not only to ensure that reproduction would go on and that the clan would survive and grow, but also to ensure that food supplies to the group were protected. So men went out to fight. But in this process of competition over land, the concept of private property or ownership of property also soon came in. And once the concept of ownership of property came in, the role of men in protecting the property being so critical, ownership of assets gradually began to shift into the hands of the male heads of clans. Once this happened, then it became extremely important. Whereas in earlier times, the only thing you knew for certain was who your mother was. It was unimportant who the father was. People called themselves as son of so-and-so or daughter of so-and-so woman, because everybody knows who your mother is. But when this property question came in and the transfer of property from one generation to another came into the picture, then it became very important for men to establish what? That the children who inherited his property are his own biological children. Now, how will he ensure that? How will you ensure that the child born to the woman that you cohabit with is definitely yours? By restricting her contact with other men, by putting her in the chaukat, by restraining her freedoms, by limiting her interactions with the outside world. And so we see the onset of patriarchy, or the rule of the father, which is what it means literally, but in practice it means the system of male domination and women's subordination. Patriarchy is also an ideology, and it is also a system of social organization. So, why did I give you this brief history? Because coming back to power structures, I wanted to illustrate to you the example of how in the ascent of patriarchy and the decline of matrilineage, force and the threat of force must have played a very important role. Obviously, initially, men had to physically restrain women. Women would not have voluntarily and gladly surrendered the freedoms and the power that they had in the earlier social order and voluntarily said, yes, fine, I will now go and sit in the angan. But the point I want to make is that in a very short period of time, it's not force itself, but the threat of force that takes over. Simply the knowledge that if I don't obey or if I don't follow a certain set of social rules, I may attract violence. And so I begin to behave in a changed manner merely because the threat of force exists. So that's the second phase. But the third phase, and the most important and most powerful means that any power structure uses to sustain itself, to perpetuate itself, and most importantly of all, and I really want to stress this, to justify itself. To say that this is the just and natural and right way to be is the creation of ideology. Now, what is ideology? You can give as complicated or as simple an answer as you wish. Ideology to me is simply a set of ideas, a set of norms which govern people's values, attitudes, and behavior. It's a simple functioning definition. Now, we can look at a very similar process in the case of race. We can look at how slaves were forcibly taken from West Africa, use of force to ship them forcibly to the West Indies, North America, South America, the threat of force which kept them in slavery, and then the ideology that because you're black, you're inferior, because I'm white, I'm superior, your brains are smaller. And what is interesting about ideology is that it partners itself. Power structures use ideology to even subsume things like science. In the 19th century, for instance, you find a whole body of literature which was at that time considered very scientific, where they weighed the brain mass. Have you come across these articles? They weighed the brain mass of Negroes and whites and browns and yellows and showed that the brain mass here is less, therefore they are less intelligent. So ideology uses any weapon at its disposal to convince those people within that power structure that is the correct power structure, that it exists for a reason, to justify itself. Now, in the case of women, the ideology is that of patriarchy, which says this is your place in society. Nature ordained this role for you. Nature made you a mother and a reproducer, and therefore that is your primary role in the power structure. And the world outside is the world of men, etc., etc. Similarly, we see the case in the Varnashrama, a clearly spelt out ideology justifying the segregation of human beings by virtue of their birth into a particular occupational group as belonging to a certain caste. And it uses many different means like religion, etc., to justify that stratification and the unequal distribution of power. Now, once a power structure is set into place, this force and threat of force recedes into the background. It doesn't need those crude weapons anymore because it's got this much more powerful instrument of ideology and ideological conditioning to keep it in place. Now, how does it do this? How is ideology transmitted? It's basically transmitted through institutions and through the structures of society. And most importantly, institutions play a major role in the socialization. I don't know if those of you at the back can see what this is, but this is a two-handed monster. One side is the process of socialization and the other side is the institutions through which the socialization of the young is achieved. Okay? Now, what are these institutions? Most important, the primary institution is the family. Education institutions, schooling, religion, and now increasingly in today's world, media. These are four very key institutions through which we are socialized. Do you all understand the word socialized? The non-social scientists. You know, socialization basically means the upbringing of the children and socializing them into the dominant ideology. That is, you're learning at your mother's knee and at your father's knee for that matter, what you should and shouldn't do, concepts of right and wrong, behavior and so on and so forth. Now, in the case of women, going back to some of our discussions yesterday, the process of socialization means that at an age when I am not in a position to critically analyze the ideas that are being put into my head, I am taught what is my place in the world, what is my destiny as a woman. As a boy as well, I am socialized into believing that a certain thing is my destiny and is my role in life. And so you have a process whereby the biological categories of male and female are transformed into social categories of gender, where the biological difference between men and women is used as a basis to construct what we call gender. And this is one of the reasons why in women's studies we have moved away from the word sex to the word gender, because gender denotes the entire construction by society through socialization, the imbibing of the ideology, and the differential access to resources to construct these two categories of male and female, and the gender stereotypes that go with these categories. Now, in case there is some few rebellious people among us who, despite their socialization, have some, as the Malayali say, kirukku, you know, some kujali in their brain which says, no, I don't accept this. This doesn't sound right. And I know many young girls, when they are small, you know, they will question. In our training programs, when we were training our women field activists, we used to do an exercise. In fact, we can do that exercise later if you like, of try and remember when was the first time in your childhood that you became aware of your gender, that you became aware that I am a boy and I'm a girl, and that's different from each other. And you'll be amazed how many of them said it was when they were learning to ride the cycle. And the brothers or cousin brothers were allowed to ride the cycle, and she was not allowed to even learn to ride the cycle, because girls, it doesn't look nice, you shouldn't ride the cycle. But there are some who, in such situations, will not quietly accept it. They will question, they will rebel, and they will say, why not? So they then begin challenging this ideology and also, therefore, the power structure. But when it happens at the level of individuals, it's very easy to contain it. It's very easy to crush it or to stamp it out, or most importantly, to expel, to isolate that individual who is not obeying the social rules.